By and large, the primary driver of likely future declines is loss of sea ice habitat. Without sea ice, you really don't have polar bears.
A new federal study paints a grim picture for polar bears. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a long-term mayor clears out of City Hall.
We just put him in the X-File. The X-File. It's a big recyclable blue bin that recycles all the paper.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued a letter of authorization today to Shell. The authorization allows the oil company to take small numbers of polar bears and Pacific walrus incidental to activities occurring during its Outer Continental Shelf 2015 exploration drilling program in the Chukchi Sea this summer. KUCB's Emily Schwing has more.
In an accompanying email, Department of Interior Press Secretary Jessica Kershaw writes that it's important to note that the letter of authorization doesn't greenlight Shell's activity this summer, nor does it preclude Shell's proposed activity. According to Kershaw, in order to proceed with exploratory drilling, Shell will have to comply with the letter of authorization and strong federal oversight. According to the letter, Shell must maintain a 15-mile buffer between its two rigs while drilling takes place. That was the subject of a letter environmental groups sent to Department of Interior Secretary Sally Jewell last week. The groups argue Shell's plan to use two rigs simultaneously violates a 2013 regulation. According to Kershaw, the 15-mile buffer distance is identified in the service's final incidental take regulations issued in June 2013 that were subject to public comment and designed to ameliorate potential impacts from oil and gas drilling on walrus and polar bears. But the well sites where Shell proposes simultaneous drilling may be too close together to be in compliance with the letter of authorization. Spokesman Luke Miller says the oil company is still evaluating the document.
It's quite a document, as most of these permits and authorizations are. So we're just reviewing it at this point and hopefully we'll have some more in the days to come.
There are other requirements laid out in the letter of authorization. Shell must also keep the Fish and Wildlife Service informed on the progress of their exploration efforts. The company also has to provide detailed marine mammal observation reports. The letter also outlines the requirements for seismic testing. The company will not be allowed to conduct offshore exploration activities within a 40-mile radius of communities that hunt marine mammals on a subsistence basis, including Barrow, Wainwright, Point Lay, and Point Hope, without specific Fish and Wildlife Service approval. Meanwhile, a second drill rig contracted by Shell is en route to Alaska. According to Luke Miller, the Noble Discoverer departed Everett, Washington Tuesday morning. Miller says it's the last of Shell's assets to leave the Pacific Northwest.
You know, we're not working under any predetermined timelines. Our focus, of course, is getting there safely. However, in 2012, the journey to Dutch Harbor from the Pacific Northwest for most vessels was about 2 to 3 weeks. So that's what we expect.
The Fish and Wildlife Service prohibits operational and support vessels from entering the Bering Strait until July 1st in order to minimize encounters with both walrus and subsistence hunters. Miller says the company is still waiting for sea ice to clear before proceeding north.
It's hard for me to say with certainty when things are going to be going. You know, as I said earlier, safety is paramount. And, you know, our plan is to go to the Chukchi once the open water permits. But at this point, you know, when Mother Nature is controlling things, you just don't know exactly when you're going to go and what your schedule is going to be.
Shell proposes to drill up to 6 wells between July and late October in the Chukchi's Burger prospect. According to the Fish and Wildlife Service, without an exemption waiver, exploration activities are only authorized between July 1st and November 30th. The Interior Department's Bureau of Safety and Environment Enforcement is still reviewing Shell's applications for permits to drill. In Unalaska, I'm Emily Schwing.
A new federal study shows Alaska's two polar bear populations could be greatly decreased in a decade. The research also shows global warming is by far the biggest threat to polar bear populations across the Arctic compared to other stressors like hunting and pollutants. The information is critical to wildlife managers as they develop and implement a recovery plan for the species that's expected to be released this week. The polar bear was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 2008. Todd Atwood is a research biologist with the United States Geological Survey and lead author of the study. He says indirectly, greenhouse gases are driving the loss of polar bear habitat, sea ice.
So if we're able to limit greenhouse gas emissions enough to reduce the rise in global temperature by 2 degrees Celsius, the outcome for polar bears is quite a bit rosier than if we don't limit greenhouse gas emissions and see them rise unabated. Based on our work, if we're able to follow a greenhouse gas trajectory, which depicts stabilization around the mid-century mark, then we'll probably have reduced populations of polar bears globally. But the outcome is substantially worse if we don't. We reckon that there's probably about an even probability that we'll see greatly decreased polar bear populations if we adhere to a stabilization greenhouse gas trajectory. If we follow an unabated greenhouse gas trajectory, then it's likely that 3/4 of the population, the global population, will be in a greatly decreased state, probably as early as the mid-century mark.
How about Alaska's population of polar bears? How do Alaska's two polar bear populations fare in either of these models?
So what we did with the models is we looked at, rather than looking at individual populations, we looked at regional populations. So there are 19 polar bear subpopulations, and we grouped them into kind of intermediate spatial scale units called ecoregions. And these ecoregions are defined based on similarities in sea ice characteristics and also similarities in polar bear life history. So the two Alaska subpopulations, the Southern Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea, grouped together with some Russian populations into the Polar Basin Divergent Ice Ecoregion. If we look at it at an ecoregional scale, we project that it'll probably reach a greatly decreased state as early as 2025, 2030. And that projection is based largely on future patterns of sea ice availability. That area is leading the Arctic in the loss of summer sea ice habitat. We're seeing the open water season, the period of time where there's no sea ice over the continental shelf, increase at a rate of about 17 days per decade. So when there's no sea ice over the water, polar bears have no access to prey.
Your study ranks other stressors to polar bears beyond global warming. What has the biggest potential to further reduce polar bear populations, and how would you rank those?
Well, the main reason why we did this work was to try and understand all the various threats to long-term persistence of polar bears at a global scale. Loss of sea ice habitat is by far the overwhelming threat to long-term persistence. If you're able to mitigate the loss of sea ice habitat, you can reduce the probability of a given ecoregion population transitioning into a greatly decreased state by as much as 50%. If you look at some of the other threats like hunting or defensive life kills or exposure to contaminants, to parasites and disease, you really don't get much payback for the amount of effort invested to manage those threats. If you reduce hunting, you might be able to reduce the probability of being in a worsened population outcome by, say, 5 to 7%. Pollution, maybe 3 to 5%. That doesn't mean that they're not important, but it means that they're really kind of a band-aid to buy us time to try and deal with greenhouse gas emissions, which are driving the decline in sea ice habitat.
Todd Atwood is a research biologist with the United States Geological Survey. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, solving the childcare crunch in Petersburg.
What a wonderful problem to have here in a community where we have too many kids and people that want to go to work.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Today marks the end of Dan Sullivan's 6 years as mayor of Anchorage. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes spoke to Sullivan about what he'll keep as he was packing up his office in City Hall.
That's from the Arctic Winter Games.
Oh, cool.
Sullivan often calls himself the CEO of the city and has an equally candid, business-like approach to administrative transition.
There's nothing magic about it.
Incoming Mayor Ethan Berkowitz has handled his transition from a different building, and while the changeover has been smooth, it isn't particularly intimate. Berkowitz ran a campaign for mayor that was in many ways a reaction against the Sullivan administration, picking up support from liberal and union constituencies that disliked many of the administration's policies. Even the inauguration celebrations bear different tones. Berkowitz has a high school folk rock band opening his ceremony Wednesday in a public park, followed by hip-hop and Alaska Native dancers. Sullivan's inauguration in 2009 was more buttoned down inside the Performing Arts Center.
Certainly people singing national anthem and state flag songs, so a bit more formal. Second term, we really didn't do much of an inauguration at all, just got sworn in, and that was that.
When an administration changes, there's lots of just stuff that has to be sorted. Reports, old budgets, speeches. The important documents are housed with the city manager's office, and the bulk of electronic files are archived for public record. But then there are artifacts falling somewhere between professional and personal. Plaques, photos, even, for Sullivan, files on subjects of special interest, like a sales tax.
You don't want to just throw it away. But then, you know, you almost convince yourself that it exists somewhere else in the city. So I think when I get home, I'll probably do winnowing part two, and probably get rid of about half of what I just took home.
Then there's all the paper and clutter that just doesn't make the cut.
We just put them in the X file.
The
X file. It's that big recyclable blue bin that recycles all the paper.
Sullivan has held political positions in Anchorage for a decade and a half, starting with 3 terms on the assembly. And if he has a next step in mind, short or long term, he isn't saying what it is.
What are you going to do for the rest of the summer?
Don't know. Have no plans. Going to go down visit my daughter in Oregon a little bit, but other than that, I think something outside of government. I've been an elected official for 15 years. It's time to do something different.
Mayor Ethan Berkowitz takes office tomorrow. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
State officials lifted bans today on open burning and use of fireworks for most of Alaska. They cited a decrease in fire danger due to recent cool and rainy weather and requests by members of the public to allow cookouts, campfires, and pyrotechnics for this weekend's 4th of July celebrations. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Both the State Forestry and Fire Marshal's Office lifted their respective statewide bans on burning and fireworks today, with some exceptions. Forestry spokesman Tim Mowry says his agency's decision is based mainly on increased rainfall and decreased temperatures that have set in over the past few days, and forecasts for more precipitation leading up to the weekend.
Conditions have moderated in a lot of areas, especially with this anticipation of more rain.
Mowry says forestry's burn ban remains in effect in the Anchorage area and in western and southwestern portions of the state. He says the latter two areas haven't gotten any of the showers that have helped reduce fire dangers in the eastern interior and south central.
They're not getting any precipitation out by Tanana, Galena, McGrath area. They haven't received hardly anything, and fires are still very active out there.
Ken Frederick, a spokesman for the Alaska Fire Service, says wildfires burning on military training ranges and other federally administered lands haven't gotten much rain either.
Parts of the military zone, it's still pretty dry, and it's going to take a lot more rain than a couple days to really make a difference on those fires.
Mowry agrees, and he emphasizes that forestry is depending on members of the public to be very careful if they build a campfire or spark a charcoal barbecue.
For sure. sort of counting on them to do that, to have that responsibility, because our resources are stretched pretty thin, and we don't need new fires.
Likewise, he says, with fireworks.
You know, the public really needs to be cognizant of how dangerous fireworks can be, and, you know, don't be setting off fireworks in the woods or anywhere where it's going to cause a fire.
The state fire marshal's office also urged extreme caution in a news release issued this afternoon to announce that it had canceled a temporary ban on the sale of fireworks in some areas. Those include the Fairbanks North Star, Kenai Peninsula, and Mat-Su boroughs, along with the municipality of Anchorage and the Tanana and Copper River valleys. Mowry says forestry's decision was based in part on numerous requests from the public to loosen the restrictions because of reduced fire danger and for the July 4th celebrations. But he suggested fans of fireworks might want to wait until later in the year when there's less daylight to dampen the show.
Wait till it's dark and you can enjoy them.
Today's announcements come on the heels of news that the amount of land burned by wildfire this month had set a new record. More than 2,400 square miles were blackened in June, easily breaking the old record for the month of just over 1,800 square miles set in 2004. The AP reported there were 612 wildfires burning statewide as of Tuesday. The Alaska Interagency Coordination Center says more than 1.6 million acres have burned so far this year. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
There is not enough child care in Petersburg. One of the preschools, the Petersburg Children's Center, has a waiting list of 45 kids. But as KFSK's Angela Denning reports, a planned expansion could help drop that number.
It's mid-morning, and a handful of toddlers are stomping and growling around a colorful room. These kids are in the toddler room at the Petersburg Children's Center. The center cares for 45 children, ages 6 weeks to pre-kindergarten. The center also runs an after-school program for kids kindergarten through sixth grade called Eagle's Nest. There are 24 children in that program with a waiting list as well.
Okay, go find your dot.
The toddlers find their places on the floor and settle into story time.
Should we read another story?
Yeah.
Owl babies.
Through the door is Brandy Heppy's office. She is the director of the Children's Center. She says she takes calls all the time from parents needing childcare.
I'm very honest with them, and I let them know right off the bat that we do have a wait list, and I have no problem putting them on there because you never know with people moving or classrooms adjusting or changing.
The waiting list has increased in the last few years, especially with the 3 to 4 year olds. The center just can't take more children without a larger space and additional workers. It's a state-licensed private nonprofit and follows State of Alaska guidelines, which set class sizes. The center employs 11 full-time workers and 4 part-time. Heppy says smaller class sizes work better anyway.
We just want to make sure that children are being taken care of and valued, and just the quality of childcare that we want to come out of here just to go on for years and years. Because I remember coming here as a child, and the quality of the care is the exact same as it is now. Sorry.
Harbor office.
Glorianne Wallen is in the Petersburg Harbor office answering a constant stream of phone calls. She's the borough's harbor master, and summer is her busy time. She's also a well-known volunteer in town, and helping the Children's Center is her new focus. She says she learned about the center's long waiting list during a borough assembly meeting.
So I just started thinking about that. You know, what a wonderful problem to have here in a community where we have too many kids and people that want to go to work. So I thought, you know, gosh, this should be something that we should try and do something about.
She heard that the center wanted to build an addition in order to take more kids, so she decided to donate her own money to the project. Then she checked in with the borough's Economic Development Council to see if it was an economic issue. The answer was yes, and the council's board donated $10,000 to the cause. A few more people have come on board, and Wallen hopes the momentum continues.
This is a project that we could maybe help ourselves with rather than going to the state and waiting for them to give us money and know how to do this.
The seed money has grown to $22,000. With that, the center is going ahead with the project with the hopes that more funds will come forward. Construction is set to start this fall. The plan includes adding two classrooms to the west side of the building. The labor would be all volunteer, happening on nights and weekends. Local businesses have agreed to help get supplies at cost. The project's estimated price tag is less than $100,000. Wallen says it will be money well spent. The expansion will allow 12 more kids into the center.
Now they just have wonderful programs, and these little kids are learning things and sparking interests at young ages, and I'm just so impressed with what they're doing up there.
Okay, are you guys ready?
Yeah.
What shape is this?
Octagon.
Good job.
Octagon.
Should we count how many sides it has?
Back at the center, the toddlers sit on the floor and learn their shapes. The expansion project comes just as the Petersburg Children's Center celebrates its 40th anniversary this year.
Nice. Good job, friends.
In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Michael.
A rectangle.
A rectangle.
Can you guys say rectangle?
Rectangle.
Rectangle. Good job.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Chinook salmon returning to Nooshigak and 10 other Alaska rivers have gotten smaller in the past few decades, according to a study done by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more.
After fishermen pointed out what they thought was a change in the size of king salmon returning to the Copper River, researchers from Fish and Game looked at data from 10 Alaska rivers. Regional Fisheries Management Coordinator Bert Lewis says they found that king salmon today are smaller than they were 30 years ago, which is as far back as the size data they used went.
Then we took a more detailed look at the data and found that the primary reason for this decline in size was a shift in the dominant age class of the fish returning to spawn.
It's not just a matter of younger fish swimming home. Lewis says the older fish also appear to be smaller now than they used to be. The trend held true on all 10 rivers studied. The Yukon, Kuskokwim, Kugluk, Kanaktok, Good News, Deshka, Kenai, Copper, Unik, and here in the bay, the Nooshigak. The researchers don't know exactly why the fish are getting smaller, but Lewis says the fact that the trend holds true for all the rivers helps narrow down potential causes.
It suggests that something is acting on them all in the same way, and that, what are they all exposed to at the same time? The marine environment. And we know that the marine environment has been changing.
What happens when fish are smaller? Lewis says the loss of big females could mean fewer Chinooks in the future.
The size of a fish is important, especially when you think about large females that come back, because they have many more eggs, and their eggs are bigger, so they get better survival rates. And they also use habitat where they spawn and lay their eggs in larger gravel substrate that is not available to smaller fish, and that also increases the survival.
In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
The Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly is considering an ordinance that would scale back habitat protections for anadromous waters throughout the Kenai Peninsula. Opponents of the ordinance claim these freshwater salmon migrate must be safeguarded. Supporters believe the protections imposed on the rights of property owners. KBBI's Quinton Chandler has more.
The borough's anadromous waters habitat protection areas have been mired in controversy ever since the protections were extended to include all anadromous waterways in the Kenai Peninsula borough area. The current law prohibits any kind of land development within 50 feet of the protected waters' shorelines. A few waterways are excluded from the law, including waters in the Seward Bear Creek flood service area. Assemblymember Wayne Ogle of Nikiski is a co-sponsor of Ordinance 2015-14. The measure would reduce the anadromous habitat protection areas to just the Kisilof and Kenai River watersheds.
Our ordinance would basically peel that back where only those two watersheds would be protected like they were back in the 2000 era in which it was introduced.
In its last meeting, the Borough Assembly heard an outpouring of opposition to the ordinance from residents who were adamant these restrictions are necessary to protect salmon. Michael O'Mara of Homer said pulling anadromous waters out from under the habitat protection umbrella would be devastating.
Cutting off those small tributary areas and streams from protection and considering them to be unimportant is a little bit, to me, like looking at the human circulatory system and saying, well, all of those little capillaries that lead up to the brain or down to our sexual organs are superfluous, so we might as well just cut them off.
Laura Sievert of Kenai testified that, in her opinion, assembly members in favor of removing habitat protections were acting on emotions and political beliefs rather than hard science.
And even though maybe you aren't trained biologists either, I'm assuming that the assembly members have educated themselves on this issue and that you know that buffer zones are essential for salmon habitat. Remember that your responsibility is to represent the long-term interests of the people of this borough. And I don't think you're doing your job if you only listen to a few private property owners complain about their rights.
Assemblymember Ogle says there is no imminent danger to salmon habitat, and property owners resent having restrictions forced on them.
It basically comes down to who is the better steward of the property. Is it going to be the property owners, or is it going to be some bureaucrat down at the river center?
The Borough Assembly is scheduled to vote on Ordinance 2015-14 in its July 7th meeting. Originally, the Assembly planned to hold a vote in its June 16th meeting, but that vote was called off when it was discovered the Planning Commission had not had a chance to review the measure. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Unalaska, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Molly Dishner in Dillingham, and Quentin Chandler in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.